This morning on Focus 580, we will be looking in this hour for your questions on care of companion animals, something we've done from time to time on the show. And we're also happy to welcome back as our guest, Linda Case, who teaches courses on companion animals in the Department of Animal Sciences at U of I. And her courses deal with a number of things, including the bond between humans and animals, also issues of health and behavior and nutrition. That's a particular interest of her. She's done a lot of writing on nutrition for pets, including The Dog, Its Behavior, Nutrition, and Health. That's a book. And also one on canine and feline nutrition, a resource for companion animal professionals. So these are really, they're textbooks. They're for people who are really into it at a very high level. So she knows a lot about dogs particularly. She also has dog training center in Mahomet, the Autumn Gold Dog Training Center. So if you have questions about health, about behavior, about feeding cats and dogs, sure, all those sorts of things, we'd be very happy to take your questions. And all you have to do is call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere. You can hear us, 800-222-9455. It's nice to have you back.
It's good to be here. Thanks,
Steve. One of the things I know that you would like to talk about here right at the beginning is there is a new, relatively new support group.
Yes.
That's been organized for people who have lost pets.
Right. It's actually a group called Loyal Friends. It is a group that is being offered through Provena Covenant Hospital, and it's actually through the pet through what's called their Center for Grief, Loss, and Hope. And it has just started. It's the first, I think, support group of this type in our area. The vet school here does have a call-in, a hotline, for people that are in crises from grief or loss of an animal. But this is the first ongoing support group that's been put together. And it has just started, as I said. It's going to meet on Wednesday nights at 6:30. It's in room 710 at Provena Covenant, which is right next to the Center for Grief, Loss, and Hope. And if you are interested, you can just call 337-2470 to find more about the program. It is still open to people who would like to join now. They will not be meeting this coming Wednesday, which is the 4th of July. So the next Wednesday will be the next meeting. It's been, I think, a group that's definitely, there's been quite a bit of interest in the community and certainly quite a bit of need for such a program. Mm-hmm.
What sort of things happen in the group?
Well, the group is predicated on, of course, the fact that people who lose a companion animal feel much the same way as people who lose a family member. And I think that loss and the similarities to loss of any loved one have been more and more recognized in recent years. So the founder of this program, Gloria Sachs, who has a very strong background in grief loss support groups with children, she's worked with Provena Covenant for several years with children's groups, and she has both sides of it. She also is a foster parent, if you will, for the Champaign County Humane Society, so she has a lot of animal experience as well. She recognized that, you know, many of the issues that she saw with her children were similar to issues that people who have lost a pet have, and so she's developed this program to basically have the same type of format as a grief loss support group for people. Mm-hmm. And so really its goal is to provide a group with several facilitators. I'm volunteering as a co-facilitator, and another friend is as well, to give support to people who are not necessarily suffering pathologically, you know, from grief, but who really want to talk to other people who have had loss, who understand what it's like to go through that loss, who may be experiencing some of the same things, and to have support from that. So it's an informal setting. And Gloria has several activities planned, you know, as far as reminiscing activities and that can help people through that time.
I imagine that for a lot of people that it would be really helpful, and particularly if you've had that experience and you've gone through that loss and you've talked about it with other people who can't relate to that experience.
Yes.
And I'm sure that people say, oh, well, Well, the first thing they say is, well, you can always get another one.
Exactly.
And
which is, I think it's said in good conscience, but probably not a very good thing to say
not
in
helpful.
Those cases.
Yeah, not helpful. And I think that probably it would be helpful to have the opportunity to spend time with people who have had the experience and can
right.
relate to what you're feeling like, mm-hmm. and when they say something like, well, I know how you feel, you can
right.
figure, well, they do, actually,
right.
unlike somebody else who might say, oh, well, that's too bad, I know how you feel.
Right.
Well, maybe they don't.
Right, and I think that in society there are a lot of platitudes that are kind of trotted out in response to pet loss, and then oftentimes people, again, their intent is good, because even, you know, the idea of getting another pet can often be helpful for people, but for others it's not. They're not ready yet, or they fear that they're going to try and project whatever characteristics that lost pet had onto the new pet. So people, you know, just as with human loss, people are very individual in how they deal with that. And unfortunately, society is just slowly coming to recognize that loss is loss. And you know, loss of a loved one is grief is grief, and we need to basically respect and accept that people who have lost a companion animal are going to be grieving deeply.
Yeah.
And so this provides some support for that.
Is the process much the same as it is? Is if you lost a person that was close to
yeah,
you?
Supposedly the steps of you know, denial, I can't recite them offhand, but denial, anger, you know, eventually acceptance, guilt. And I think that guilt is one that we may need to focus on more with companion animals because oftentimes because our companion animals cannot tell us that they're sick, we may miss some things. Or the other issue that comes up often is that unlike with humans, we have, you know, and this is, I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, but we have the ability to make a decision about euthanasia. And that is a very traumatic time and a very difficult decision. And there can be a lot of guilt associated with whether or not we did it at the right time, whether or not it was the right thing to do. And I think that, you know, that's an issue that probably we don't see as much anyway with human loss, or it's a little bit different anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the studies that have been done, there are actually a number of social workers who have concentrated on the area of pet loss. Colorado State University has actually a very strong program in their veterinary college that teaches veterinarians or vet students how to deal with loss in their clients.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Linda Case from the U of I Department of Animal Sciences. She teaches companion animal courses there and knows a lot about animal, particularly dog behavior and health and nutrition, and has written a lot about nutrition for both cats and dogs. So if you have some questions, I know she'll do her best to help you out. You can call us 333-WILL or 9455 and toll free 800-222-WILL. Just to, maybe to pick up on the last point you talked about, that sometimes people, their reaction when their animals get sick is they start feeling a little bit guilty because they think, well, somehow I should have been able to figure out that something was going on. There might be some obvious signs that there would be a problem. If animals, if they're listless, if suddenly their normal activity level goes down, if they're not eating,
right.
If there seems to be some sort of obvious change in bowel and bladder activity, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, might be some things that you would right away say, well, I wonder if something's going on,
right,
and you might want
right.
to consult your vet. Is there anything else, though, that might be a little bit more subtle that you might suggest that people be thinking about and
right.
paying attention to?
Well, I think one of the things that tends to happen is, you know, just like people, as dogs get older, they're going to be more susceptible to things, is that we may have a tendency to think, well, you know, he's slowing down because he's getting older, and not realize that there might actually be something more going on. You mentioned eating, and that is, you know, especially with cats and certainly with dogs. Especially, I live with golden retrievers. Especially with golden retrievers, if a golden retriever doesn't eat, you know something's very wrong, and so that's a clear sign. And you know, I think that if people have a certain routine that they have with their dog, such as a certain length of walk or a certain, you know, that they do every day and a certain way of feeding and time of feeding, changes in those routines that even are just really subtle could mean something. Jack Brighton and I were talking before the show about you know, we both have recently lost very elderly dogs, and the fact that our dogs just have such spirit that they seem to be able to handle and basically hide some severe, you know, health problems that, you know, we'd be whining about. You know? And you know, so they hang in there before we even are aware. So we, I think even more so than with people, because of course people have the ability to verbally tell you what's going on. And obviously our communication patterns between people are much clearer. So we have to be really aware of subtle things that mm-hmm. might be happening.
Yeah, that's where we want to give special points to vets. I guess the doctors we single out for special points are vets and pediatricians,
mm-hmm. yeah.
because in both cases their patients really can't tell right. them what's going
right.
on. You know, they have to be intuitive enough and in tune enough to be able to pick up things where they can't say. So, does it hurt here? Does it
right.
hurt? Does it hurt if I do this? Does it hurt if I do
right.
this?
Right. Yeah, and some dogs, you know, it really varies, but some dogs are just so stoic that that they won't show. You know, they won't yipe or. You know, we've had both extremes in our family. We've had one dog who, you know, if he stubbed his toe, he came running with holding his foot up, you know. He was the biggest baby in the world. And then our little girl that we just lost, she was just, you know, she could be in excruciating pain and she would just be very quiet about it. So just like, you know, people have different thresholds, so do dogs.
Yeah. I think we're getting some calls lined up here and ready to go. Maybe I'll give the cell phone number again if you're here in Champaign, Urbana. 333-9455, and that's so for local folks. But we also do have that toll-free line. That one is good anywhere you may be listening. If it was a long-distance call, use that, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. And we have a caller right here to talk with in Champaign, line one.
Good Hello? Morning.
Yes.
I live in residential northeast Urbana. We're being inundated by squirrels. And it's okay to have one or two around, but recently we got four or five young squirrels, and they're just working on our vegetation. They're digging holes all over the yard. They're a nuisance with my bird feeders. What can I do to reduce the population of those squirrels?
That's a little outside of our area of expertise here, I'm afraid. I'm not sure what you can do other than you can trap them and you can take them someplace else. I think that's probably...
I know that the Champaign County Humane Society will loan out traps, humane traps. In fact, I know a gentleman we live in Mahomet, and I know a gentleman who does this regularly. I see him out in the trail. He'll come out and release his squirrels out there. And I think that's probably the best solution, you know, just
okay,
to relocate.
You say the Humane Society can help us on this?
Yeah, they will loan out humane traps for you. So you just need to call over there. I think you deposit, you know, a fee, and then you just get that feedback when you bring the trap.
Is there any danger? And after you collect them, you have to stay away from the cage a little bit?
I would just be careful. We've trapped raccoons quite a bit out in our house, and we've had no problem. I mean, they're more afraid of you than you are of them. But you definitely would not want, you know, the squirrel to think he's cornered. So I'd just be very careful. And the way the traps are set up, you can open them and release them without you can actually, you know, be a foot away so that you don't have to actually get really close when you release the squirrel.
Sorry to ask the wrong question.
Oh, okay.
No, that's fine.
I thought a vet would know.
Yeah.
Thanks
yep.
again.
All right, very good. And other questions here, particularly here we're talking about dogs and cats. Squirrels too, whatever, you know, whatever. You can give us a call, 333-WILL and toll free, 800-222-WILL. See, what you've got to do is get yourself a dog.
Yeah.
Have the dog run around in the backyard, do a lot of barking, and chase those squirrels
yeah.
the way they...
Yeah, I think squirrels are, they know they can get in the trees and the dogs can't.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one thing that we might talk a little bit more about is living with an older
mm-hmm.
animal,
sure.
an older dog in particular. Are there particular ways that you want to kind of change the way you think about care and the basic things that you're doing
mm-hmm.
when you have an animal that's getting into the old age category?
Sure, sure. I guess there are a couple of things that come to mind when I think about older animals. One is that you cherish every moment. You know, because, you know, an older dog knows, you know, their personality's developed. You have a history with that dog or with that cat. You know, you have your routine. There are many wonderful things about having an older animal. And I think sometimes because we're so worried about losing the animal and having illness, you know, start, that we forget that point. So, you know, I think one of the first things is to try and keep in mind that, you know, that this dog is possibly not going to be with you that much longer, and to really enjoy that time. As far as their care goes, the important thing to do is to, you know, as we talked about earlier, is to be aware of subtle changes. For example, exercise is a really important thing. And it's kind of a double-edged sword, because as dogs get older, just as people do, their metabolism naturally decreases. Their body composition changes, and actually that's why their metabolism declines. And so they are going to be more prone to weight gain. And added to that is that many older animals, dogs and cats, have a little bit of arthritis as they get older, some more severe than others. So their exercise tolerance also decreases. So it's double whammy, you know, that, and so your chance of having the dog gain weight are pretty high. And, you know, you may think, oh, well, that's no big deal. But actually it is, because it does negatively impact health. You know, if the dog is really heavy and they cannot get around, they're going to basically have a lower quality of life, because they can't go for the great walks they used to go for. And it also, just as in people, there are many health risks associated with that. So exercise tolerance is an important aspect. And generally, what we recommend in our training school and in my classes is to let the animal tell you. As the dog gets older, you know, maybe 7 years plus, it's a really good idea to increase the frequency with which you go to the veterinarian, to do some baseline, you know, just do, you know, total blood counts, blood chemistry panel, and have those, you know, on record so that you know if there are any changes every 6 months. As far as exercise goes, you may need to decrease the level of how strenuous that activity is. For example, you know, my husband and I run with our dogs, and typically we've been able to keep running with our dogs until they're 10 or 11. But we let the dog tell us if they're arthritic, if they're not as heat tolerant as they once were. So exercise is very important, keeping a very regular routine. And again, you know, frequent health checks.
Yeah, particularly, I'm sure that you need to think about the issue of heat and hydration mm-hmm. this time of year.
Oh, definitely.
I guess dogs seem to be kind of at their best when it's cool.
Yes,
and
yes,
they have fewer problems. And when you start to see more kinds of problems, it is when in the warmer time.
Yes,
of
good.
The year.
Yeah, really good point. And that's mainly because we have sweat glands in our skin, and dogs don't. The only way they have to rid themselves of excess heat is through respiration, panting, and then they have a few little sweat glands in the pads of their feet, but they, as far as heat loss goes, they don't do much. So definitely that's an issue, is hydration and keeping them cool.
Here's another caller in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, a question I hope is right up your alley. For both dogs and cats, is it possible to raise a healthy and happy pet without using animal protein in the feed?
Oh, good question. I'm a vegetarian myself, so it's a question I'm very interested in. It's very easy for dogs. Dogs, kind of the going statement about dogs is that they're omnivores who are better fed as carnivores. However, it's quite easy to give a dog everything that they need on a completely vegetarian diet. The issue that, you know, saying that they're better fed as carnivores has to do with a few specific nutrients. There's some question that maybe dogs need more taurine than we once thought, which is only found in animal sources. As far as certain fatty acids, there's, you know, some issue with some of those. But in general, a dog, it can be fed a vegetarian diet. Not so for cats, however. Cats are obligate carnivores, and there are certain nutrients that they do have to have that only come from animal products. Now, you could create a vegetarian diet for cats if you added those nutrients in purified form into the diet. But, you know, if you look at the evolutionary history of the cat evolved as an obligate carnivore. They evolved as an animal who hunted other animals. So as far as their natural diet, it would include some animal protein.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Now, I know some people would say, they'd say, you look like you're doing quite well yourself on the vegetarian diet. You look super. But why would you want to do, you know, make a dog a vegetarian? Is there actually some health benefits?
I think that we're kind of going over into the realm of ethical issues here. As far as, you know, evolutionary history goes, the dog is a hunter. There's no doubt about that. The reason that they're able to exist on a vegetarian diet is that wolves and coyotes, you know, canids are very commonly scavengers as well. In fact, there's some groups of coyotes in the United States that certain times of the year live exclusively on fruit and do just fine. Mm-hmm. The cat, however, is not a scavenger. The cat, you know, this is why, you know, people say, you know, my dog caprophagizes, eats feces, and my cat doesn't. Why is that? Well, because dogs are scavengers by nature. They'll eat anything that doesn't eat them first, generally. Cats, on the other hand, are a little more finicky, as we all know. So as far as evolutionary history goes, they both really should be fed as carnivores. That is how they evolved. I think what the issue is for many people has more to do with possibly what's in pet food or what they perceive as in pet food, or with modern farming practices today and how animals are raised and slaughtered. And so they're making an ethical decision that they don't want to support a particular way of getting animals into our food. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, it's not, for many people, it's not simply a health issue. If it was, I think that's a little misguided because, you know, dogs and cats are definitely different from humans.
Yeah. Well, there has been concern in a number of species about a group of diseases called spongiform encephalopathies,
right,
and the possibility of transmitting these diseases,
right,
by feeding parts of one animal to another,
right,
animal. Is there any of that kind of concern when it comes to our domestic cats and dogs?
Right. As far as BSE goes, there's one case that I know of a cat in Great Britain that they believe was a confirmed case of BSE. And one of the theories with that is that, you know, typically BSE is something that takes many years to develop, that you can be infected and not show clinical signs until many years later. So one of the thoughts is that, you know, dogs and cats don't live long enough to develop it. Another is that, you know, we are, you know, as you've probably read with BSE in humans, is that we're at the tip of the iceberg, that we're going to start to see cases. But as far as I know, I've read of one case in Great Britain in a cat that they thought was an actual case.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here of this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Linda Case. She teaches in the Department of Animal Sciences at U of I. She teaches companion animal courses where she deals with issues like anatomy and reproduction and health and disease and behavior. And also she's written a lot about animal nutrition, particularly for dogs and cats. So if you have questions, you can give us a call. You have questions about feeding your animals, about taking care of them, about behavioral and training issues. She's also the owner of Autumn Gold Dog Training Center in Mahomet, where they conduct classes for puppies and beginners and older dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have questions on behavioral issues, we can talk about those too. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. Maybe just, we had been talking before about older dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more about feeding. And again, given the fact that we do nutrition, the metabolism is going to change,
mm-hmm,
and maybe the level of activity that they're interested in and can tolerate will change.
Right.
So you need to be paying attention to how much you're feeding them and what,
right,
you're feeding them. And is there at some point where, as your dog gets older, you should start thinking about their diet and possibly changing it and using something that is specifically formulated for older dogs?
Right. Actually, it's a very good question because our knowledge of canine nutrition and feline nutrition has expanded greatly in recent years. And, you know, I grew up with the one bag in the supermarket, you know, complete and balanced for all life stages. And you started at a year old and, you know, a dog's 15 and he's still getting the same food. And we know now that just as in people, there are shifts in our metabolism and our nutrient needs of the animals as they get older. And more is understood about geriatric nutrition. A few of the things that are really important is that, as we said, metabolism declined, and so energy needs are lower for older dogs, but they still have very similar essential nutrient requirements. So energy's lower, but they still need those same nutrients. So basically what pet food companies are doing is they're formulating a food that's less energy dense, but still packed with nutrients. So it still has enough nutrients that even though they're getting fewer calories per cup. They're also getting enough protein, and actually protein's a big issue. There's it's one of those myths that just won't die, that high protein causes renal disease in older dogs. We now know that's not true. Only in extremely uremic dogs can it even exacerbate renal disease, and then it's just exacerbating symptoms. There's not even proof that it hurts the kidney. So it's been typical for people to think, oh, my dog's older, I have to decrease his protein intake. We now know that if anything, that's contraindicated, that older dogs need a good source of high-quality protein at about levels maybe even a little higher than for a dog that's just at maintenance. So protein's an issue, energy. Another really neat thing that's going on is we know that they're not really nutrients, nutricuticals, I guess we'd call them, that can be added to the diet, such as glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate, can help with arthritic problems. And a lot of pet foods are being formulated to include those for geriatric animals. So I would definitely recommend switching to a geriatric diet as your animal ages, because we just know so much more today.
Okay. And are they pretty much all the same?
Ooh. This is where, you know, I think consumer education is very important, because, you know, philosophies differ among pet food companies. Some, you know, believe in one approach versus another. So I think the best thing here is to talk to your veterinarian, get literature from the company, definitely buy from a reputable pet food company, you know, rather than a generic or price brand.
Okay. We have several callers here ready to go. And we'll take them in the order they came in. First in Champaign, line one.
Hello. I have two cats, two male cats. They're brothers, and they've been neutered and declawed. And just recently, one of them started spraying the house.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was there were some cats outside. A neighbor got some new cats, and
mm-hmm.
And so this one cat was very territorial.
Sure.
So my vet recommended to give him a little bit of Valium twice a day, and then we tried to cut that back. Well, I still had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, I got real exasperated one day, and I just let them out.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been, and I haven't had that problem anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're not spraying. So I go out, I let them out when I'm home, just for, you know, a few hours, and then they come back in to eat because it's, I try to leave them out, and know that they'll be back in an hour or two to eat.
Sure.
So I've been doing that. Two things I noticed, first of all, was that they're not as affectionate with me now. They just, all they think about is eating and getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Will that subside eventually?
Well, there's probably a couple things happened here. You basically, by letting them out, you change their territory.
Uh-huh.
Cats have two types of territories, their home range and what's called their home territory. Mm-hmm. And basically, indoor cats, those two territories are the same. When they're outside, they have a home range that's bigger, and that's basically where they go to visit and they go to see other cats. And in the United Kingdom, it's much more common for people to have indoor-outdoor cats than it is here. And I think, you know, one of that has to do with population density, and one of the reasons is cultural. And so most of the studies that have been done on indoor-outdoor cats are from the United Kingdom. And what they've shown is that a cat who goes indoor-outdoor tends, this is why your dilemma is kind of interesting, they tend to have stronger greeting behaviors with their owners than cats who are indoors all the time. But overall, they're less affectionate because, you know, the way I think of it is because they have another life.
Yeah.
You know, they have things going on. You know, they're out having fun with other cats. And so for your cat, in your cat's case, since they started out as exclusively indoor cats, the reason that you saw a decline in the spraying is because you changed their territory. Mm-hmm. Now, they probably are spraying outside somewhere,
yeah.
You know, especially if those other cats are around somewhere.
Yeah.
And they don't feel as threatened inside because now their home range and their home territory isn't inclusive anymore.
Oh.
So you solve that problem, except, of course, you know, the big little, you know, worry for me here would be, are your cats safe? You know, that because of you know, that they could get hit by cars or beat up by another cat. You know, those are certainly issues. And then the affectionate part, I think, is probably two-pronged. One is probably that since they were exclusively indoor cats, this is a whole new life for them, and they're just, they're kind of out partying. And you're secondary now.
Yeah.
And so that might subside. But again, you know, studies have shown that the interesting, you know, one of the explanations for the increased greeting with an indoor-outdoor cat is that it's thought when an indoor-outdoor cat comes in, that greeting is actually remarking their territory, you know, and you're part of their territory.
I see.
So you might want to watch for that, and then you could kind of capitalize on it. You know, when they come in, that might be the time that you really want to, you know, pet them and hang out with them and be buddies, because they're going to be more inclined probably to greet you then.
I try to give them a treat every time they come in, so they'll be more, you know, anxious to, you know,
sure,
when they come in.
Sure. Yeah.
Now the other thing is,
did you say they're declawed also?
Yeah, and I know.
Yeah, that's kind of a concern.
It is. Yeah. I just hated to do it, but if he was going to continue spraying,
sure,
Do something.
Was it just one that was spraying?
Yeah.
And did, as far as you know, did your neighbor bring their cats in, or are their cats still roaming?
Well, they could go in and out.
So see, that's not going to subside then, because you're exactly right. What caused that was seeing other cats outside the door, and that's a real, you know, problem, because it wasn't your fault that happened, and no one wants to have a cat spraying in their house either.
No, I'm going to go away for a few days, and they'll be in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the spraying will come back, or should I put them back on the field?
Well, the Valium, there are some other drugs that actually have been more efficacious than Valium in cats. And I don't know if either your cats are overweight, but one of the problems with Valium is that it can predispose to diabetes if it's used for a long time.
It's called diazepam.
Yeah, diazepam. Yeah, that's Valium.
Uh-huh.
So you may want to talk to your vet about trying, you know, some other drugs.
Okay, because I would catch it. Now, the other thing is, they probably need shots if they're going to be outside, too.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, they had one basic shot, whatever that was. I forgot what it was.
Yeah. And again, you know, there are other dangers here that you need to consider. And I know it's a dilemma for you, but, you know, cars, other cats, dogs, you know, their life is definitely in danger when they're outside, you know, so that's something to consider.
I know so many people who have let their cats go in and out.
Yeah, again, you know, it's there are many people that feel very strongly that the cat has a more exciting life if they go in and out.
Yeah.
So it's definitely an issue, you know, you have to kind of come to grips
with. So I should get some more shots.
Oh, definitely.
And then maybe talk to the vet.
Do you know
behaviorists, would that help if I took them to a behaviorist, like at the vet, at the vet medicine here?
I don't know if there's anyone here at VetMed. It's certainly, you know, they might be able to give you a little more insight. But again, you know, the spraying you're describing is directly related to territorial marking.
Yeah.
And the cats who feels for whatever reason that their territory is being threatened will spray or will mark. So that's probably what precipitated it. And again, by letting them out, you're not changing territorial behavior, you're just shifting their territory.
So is there no real, outside of getting some more medication, is that the only thing you can do with a cat spraying?
Well, the other thing is to try and somehow limit, you know, their ability to see that their territory is being threatened.
Yeah, I did that. I pulled all the blinds.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, if you could keep them out of the rooms where they could see the other cats.
Cat circles the house, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you might want to speak to your neighbors. You know, I know that can be difficult, but that's another option.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This caller's in Urbana. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted you to address maybe a little bit the issue of companionship with animals in general, since that's your specialty. And I find that there are a lot of people, that people almost feel guilty about their attachment to animals? That people, you know, relatives and stuff say, oh, it's crazy to be so attached to your animal. Why would you grieve when your cat dies? And then also my second question that's kind of related is, do you think there really is a difference between a cat person and a dog person?
Oh, I like that question.
Okay, well, you can answer either.
Okay. Well, regarding the first one, I think that is a cultural bias that we have that is shifting. You know, if you look, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, I think that it was, you know, if you openly wept about the loss of a pet, you know, you would have maybe been institutionalized. At least today, I think that there is more acceptance of this. You know, the fact that, you know, Provena Covenant, it has an ongoing grief loss support group for people who've lost pets, the fact that the Vet College has a grief loss support hotline. These are all, you know, these are all indicative of societal changes in attitude. So I think that there has been a shift, just as, you know, there's a shift in other, you know, social changes that we have as we go along. But I do think that you're right. I think that, you know, especially if someone is, if their companion animal is the only person or individual with whom they share their home, there's that stigma of oh, you're one of those cat ladies. and, you know, it's interesting because we're such a nation of extremes, and then on the one hand, we're accepting that bond more readily. On the other hand, you know, as many people know, the idea of hoarding animals and treating this as a psychological problem has really come into the public eye recently. And, you know, I think that's a very important thing to bring up. But what's a little bit, you know, dangerous about that is what comes along with it is the idea of, oh, someone has three cats, they, you know, there's something wrong. And, you know, I think that's not what an animal hoarder is, certainly. But, you know, you worry that there could be some connotations there of just having a lot of animals indicates a psychological problem. So, you know, to support the bond, really since the early 70s, there's been a great deal of research that's looked at what actually is the human companion animal bond, what makes that bond up. And of course, in early studies tended to focus on the animal as a child substitute, and the fact that we have a need to nurture, we're a very social species, and that we just extend that need to nurture to animals. What was interesting was as they examined people's attitudes towards their pets, they found that there were some characteristics of the bond that were not similar to the parent-child bond or the need to just the need to nurture. Things such as play, the fact that we continue to play with our dogs even when they're adults, things such as exercise. Also, the what was ignored for a number of years was that it's not a one-way bond. You know, the thought that, well, you need to nurture, so you extend and you project that need onto an animal. What we now recognize is that the animal's personality brings as much to the, you know, to the table as the person does, and that there's been more focus in recent years on animal personalities and how those affect the bond, you know, or, you know, good for good or for bad. So, you know, other benefits that people brought out were the fact that they feel more secure when they're with an animal, which would be very dissimilar to a strict, you know, child-parent relationship. The fact that animals as social facilitators are another one. That's an area that's been examined a great deal. There's a classic study that was done. A researcher, Peter Messant, in England, he had people walk through a park either with a dog, a friendly dog, or by themselves, and they measured eye contact with other people, spontaneous interactions, and then if there were interactions, how long those interactions occurred. And the difference between with the pet and without a pet was, you know, astronomically different. You know, it's very significant that whenever people walk with a pet, they not only had eye contact more often, they had positive interactions, and when they had interactions, they lasted for a longer period of time. And that kind of kicked off a number of studies that looked at the facilitating effect that an animal can have on our interactions with other people. And the nice thing about that researcher was that it kind of dispelled that myth that, oh, well, you love animals, so you must hate people, which is a really, you know, common myth. And then just in recent years, there was a study that actually looked at, compared people who were pet owners to non-owners and the type of human relationships that they had. And it wasn't a very strongly significant difference, but there was actually the people who had animals tended to have more human friendships and human relationships than those who did not. So it certainly didn't, the research did not support the idea that, you know, you shift all your bonding to animals and you don't bond with people. So that idea has been dispelled as well. So I hope that, you know, allays some of your some of your fears.
Very interesting. Sure. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we'll go on here to another caller. This is also Urbana. It's line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I have two cats. 10 years old, and they have been on a special diet to, you know, for urinary tract infections.
Mm-hmm.
My other cats have had and died, but they are so thin.
Oh.
They are, you know, one is just concave, although, you know, he acts normal.
Mm-hmm. And they're both 10 years old, you said?
They're 10 years old.
Mm-hmm. And do you see them eating? Do they eat?
Oh, yeah, they eat. The one that's concave just does not like this too much, but, you know, what mm-hmm. else does he have? They do go out and catch animals and eat them, which probably isn't good for them either.
Mm-hmm. Have you had them to the veterinarian recently?
Well, no, it's hard for me to get it to them. But
sure.
The last time the one was there, he said, well, he's okay.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, he looks so pathetic.
Well, one of the first things that I would check for if they're going out and catching mice and birds and things is parasites. I would do a fecal check on them. You know, they could have tapeworm. They could, you know, there could be any, they could be a number of things going on,
uh-huh.
gastrointestinally. So that's the very first thing I would do.
Uh-huh.
The other thing, you know, I would actually try and figure out how much they're eating. It's, you know, cats do tend to be quite finicky, and they could just not like that particular food. As far as fluted or feline lower urinary tract disease, there are many foods. In fact, most cat foods today are formulated to be slightly acidifying to urine so that fluted doesn't occur.
Uh-huh.
And so you have the option of other foods, and that you might want to, again, talk to your veterinarian, because I don't know what food you're feeding.
Uh-huh.
But the first thing I would do is get a vet check done. And then the second thing is consider the palatability of the food.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. I'm just thinking about the woman who had the cats who had been inside cats,
mm-hmm.
and now she's letting them go outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess one of the things I'm thinking about is the fact that they've been declawed, and
yeah.
that what you've done there is you really denied them their ability to defend themselves,
right.
and whether that's a real problem, and whether it makes very much difference if the cats have just been declawed on their front
mm-hmm.
feet,
right.
Their front paws, and not all four.
Right, right. Most people do. In fact, most veterinarians recommend if you're going to declaw, if you're going to do it, that you just do the front. So most people have just done the front claws. Some I know. Some people get all four done, and then, you know, that cat's really in trouble, because at least with the back claws, many cats can adapt if they're able to, you know, climb up a tree really fast and just, you know, use their back claws. Also, this is anecdotal, and actually there are a few studies that have been done in just the last couple of years because declawing is so controversial. One of the statements that's been made is that cats who are declawed have more behavior problems. And so a large study was done about 2 or 3 years ago that looked at, you know, behavior problems in declawed cats versus cats that had their claws. And actually, that's not true. There were no differences. It was, I think, you know, just another attempt to say, you know, this is another reason that declawing is bad. So we know that behavior is not, you know, badly affected by it, but definitely the cat's ability to defend himself, definitely his ability to climb a tree. And some would say, some argue, said again, it's anecdotal, that cats who are declawed in front learn to use their back claws to fight. And to some degree, that's true, because a cat who's on the defensive, when they fight, what they do is they roll over on their back and they bring those back feet up and they rake with them.
Mm-hmm.
So they would still have that. But that's a cat who's on the defense. You know, that's a cat who's on the offense typically uses their front claws. So that's definitely an issue, and especially a cat who might be being attacked by a dog. I mean, you know, that could be a very, very bad situation for the cat.
Yeah. I think we're almost at the point where we're going to have to quit. And maybe we'll do that, as we'll say, my apologies, we have a caller we can't take, but maybe we should not let it go too long. You can
yes,
come back and
I'd
we can talk
to come
some
back
more.
Again.
And maybe just real quick, do you want to give the information
yes,
about the pet
about,
loss
yes.
group once more?
Again, it's through Provena Covenant. It's going to meet on Wednesday nights from 6:30 until 8 p.m. It's called Loyal Friends, and it's a pet loss grief support group, and it's being run through the Center for Grief, Loss, and Hope. The phone number to call is 337-2470. And again, they will not be meeting July 4th, but they will be meeting the next time on July 11th, that
okay.
Wednesday.
Well, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Our guest, Linda Case, she teaches animal companion courses at the U of I Department of Animal Sciences. Our show, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from the massage therapy professionals at Bodywork Associates of Champaign. Bodywork Associates has been providing practical relief for tired, aching muscles since 1982. Today's broadcast is also made possible with support from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market on the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. Featured homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, homemade baked goods, and original works of art. It's located at the corner of Illinois and Vine next to Lincoln Square Mall. More information is available at 384-2444.